Begin with Young Again Products versus Accord.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Joe Alfred Eisen, Jr. I represent the appellants in this case. This case started out as a trademark violation case alleging damages. It became an injunction, which was a mutual injunction that was entered, which ordered the parties not to disparage each other. It then transformed into litigation over motions for contempt about that particular injunction, which I, when you look at the record, I think you'll find that injunction became a final judgment during the course of this case. Then it resulted in litigation over the contempt motions, and that resulted in ultimately a Rule 11 sanction of $25,000, which resulted in Mr. Accord, one of the appellants, being incarcerated for 97 days for failure to pay a Rule 11 sanction in the amount of $25,000. The record will indicate that that,
sanction been paid yet?
The sanction was paid ultimately as a result of Mr. Accord's relative liquidating part of a retirement plan and paying the sanction. So the sanction is no longer at issue as far as being paid in this case. The issue is its legality. The underlying basis of that sanction was that Mr. Accord was frivolous in filing a motion claiming that Young Again Products had violated this permanent injunction or injunctive order not to disparage. There's a letter in the record that Mr. Mason, an executive with Young Again Products, wrote to a gentleman by the name of Gooby, which was definitely disparaging. I think if the court looks at it, they'll make the determination that it was disparaging. And so how can you be liable for a Rule 11 sanction when you file to enforce an injunction as a non-disparagement clause in it whenever there's been disparagement? Or even that there's an issue about whether the letter is a good faith issue about whether the letter is disparaging. So we move into that, and that's contempt, and then we roll along the pretrial hearing. And at the pretrial hearing, Marcella Ortega, who's the mother of John Accord, she's abandoned by her attorney in the middle of the pretrial. Now, we have cited in our reply brief on one of our pages a motion for new trial, which has attached evidence, which indicates to me, looking at those records, that Mr. Lobsher, the attorney for Marcella Ortega, had told her she didn't have to appear at the pretrial before he abandoned her. You have the problem of pleadings that had been filed before the pretrial by Mr. Lobsher, which presumably had been given, if we're to believe him, to his client, Marcella Ortega. And those pleadings, he's responding to motion for default judgment of Freeman attorneys who represent Young Again Products. He says nothing's wrong. He says that Marcella Ortega has made no violations. He contests default until he gets in the middle of the hearing, and then he abandons the interest of his client in the middle of the hearing. Now, this raises issues that this court has dealt with before. I think this court in the Fourth Circuit has a case which says that an attorney cannot abandon his client in the middle of proceedings like that. That is simply a synopsis of the general ethics rule, a part of the general ethics rule that none of us are allowed to abandon the interests of our clients when the going gets tough or it looks like we're being under attack or that we have our own problems, sanction-wise or others. We have to withdraw, if at all, upon an order signed by the court or the Court of Appeals at such a time when it doesn't work with prejudice to the interests of our client. And on this record, it's not just an issue of default judgment. Were they warned sufficiently? Does this look like this complied with our standards and our circuits for upholding default judgment on something like pretrial deficiency, which normally requires a warning that very severe sanctions will be put against the party defaulting? It also normally requires an all...
The district court here showed a great deal of patience. It seemed to give you chance after chance after chance. And this... the default judgment did not just rest on any one incident. It rested upon over a pattern of refusal to cooperate with the legal process in even the most elemental way.
Your Honor, I have to contest that statement. Unless statements of attorneys about the other party is proof that you can rely on in affirming a case, that statement that you've just made is simply wrong. And I specifically point to the fact that we cited in our briefs numerous orders of the district court that did not impose any sanctions. They were about discovery. They had to do with entered, agreed orders. There's nothing in those orders that supports this. I'm afraid the court is being misled by statements of counsel, which transformed their statements into orders that were supposedly made on the record. We laboriously addressed this in our reply brief. You simply, statements of attorneys are not evidence. Any attorney can get in there, make statements about opposing counsel, about opposing parties, and if the court relies on those statements, the court hasn't shown great patience because those statements are not evidence. And that's my response on that, and I'll move on to the next point. You have a situation here where...
Can I just go back to that for a second? There is in the record, I think you would agree, a fair number of comments by the district judge saying, I'm losing my patience, I think there's something wrong, this doesn't smell right to me. I also think you're right, there's no, except for the one instance, imposition of sanctions or clear warning that you're going to have a default judgment. Would you say that those two things are fair characterization of the record?
I would say that that's a fair characterization at the worst, as you can look at our case on appeal.
Okay.
Now,
the other point that seems to me that you have to deal with is that you, as I take it, are now representing both mother and son. Is that correct?
That's correct. And the mother's here in the courtroom.
And they are in two different situations, it seems to me. Would you not agree with that?
I would, and I would like to make this comment. One of the carried along issues here is, may a pro se person adopt the pleadings of another party, both on appeal or at trial? And if you say that they can't, there was never any warning in this record that this pro se person could not adopt the pleading. And the court knew that this gentleman was unrepresented for a long period of time because he allowed Mr. Lobsher to withdraw. Now, with that statement, I want to go back to abandonment in the middle of the trial. Is this court going to rule that an attorney who's challenged with sanctionable conduct can abandon a client in the middle of trial?
Excuse me a second. I don't think the district court's final order was imposed purely on the basis of a court's adoption of the pleading, Ortega's pleading. As I understand it, the order was based on the district court's impression that both of the defendants here had essentially turned themselves into saboteurs of the legal process, and there was a pattern of conduct here that the district court found that its consent injunction was violated, and there was a refusal to pay sanctions in the case of a court, and they were completely snubbed the pretrial scheduling orders, missed scheduling conferences, didn't comply with discovery orders, or filed motions for continuances and delay that were frivolous just to run the process into the ground. That if it had just been one thing, I wouldn't have been as concerned about it, but it was the accumulation of behavior.
Your Honor, there is no accumulation of behavior. I challenge the court to look at the district court's rulings, what the district court signed.
That there was.
But they can find whatever they want to find without any evidence. You reverse
the
court.
Isn't the district court in the best position to determine whether its own scheduling conferences and discovery orders and the rest have been violated?
Not without evidence, which is based simply on statements of attorneys, which are not upheld by the record. We spent long time, weeks, going through these allegations. And what we're being done, what's being done here is we're being victimized by the statements of attorneys of what they wish the record would show.
Could I clarify one thing? I understood you to, my understanding of the record is that Mr. Lobsher, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, requested and was granted permission to withdraw as in his representation of Ms. Ortega based on what he described as her failure to respond to his request for direction about the litigation. Is it your statement that he did not receive permission from the court to withdraw?
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that a court, your court, the district court, cannot allow attorneys to cut and run when their own sanctionable conduct is at issue. And simply by statements of counsel, not under cross-examination, not carefully examined by the court, self-serving, that, oh, my pleadings are wrong, that I filed before this default was entered. When I responded to the pretrial, I said that they weren't in default. They didn't do anything wrong. I told my client to stay home where she wouldn't hear what I was going to say. And now I want out of this case, Your Honor. And they strip him out of the case with a motion to withdraw. No judge has the power to
do
that.
But it's up to a district judge to sort all this out. And the question as to whether there was abandonment, as you call it, or the attorney moved to withdraw because of the fact that there was, I assume, no payment of the bills, but also just no cooperation at all. If the attorney felt that he or she just could not in conscience proceed because the client was undermining the attorney at every turn. And that's apparently the reason.
Well, it's a bad reason because the client's not there to defend themselves. Can I do that? Can I cut and run in a case? Can I withdraw when the client's not there and I tell the client not to be there?
You're characterizing it in a way that I don't believe that the trial court accepted.
Well, they have to rule by evidence. They don't rule by whim. Can you accept an attorney's uncontested but uncross-examined self-serving statements describing his own sanctionable conduct? I say to you, no, you can't do that. And it's not ethical practice in this circuit or any circuit.
Yes, an attorney is perfectly capable of explaining to a district court why it is that the attorney-client relationship has foundered and run aground. I mean, there's nothing impermissible about that, and there's nothing impermissible about attorneys telling the district court and informing the district court as to the fact that the case simply can't move forward because no one shows up for scheduling conferences or status conferences and no one complies with discovery orders. The district court's got to rely on statements from attorneys with respect to those sorts of matters.
No, Your Honor, I have to disagree with you. There is a responsibility when you swear an oath to uphold the Constitution to give each party due process. You cannot allow an attorney who tells his client to stay home, who is acting in conflict of interest, to make self-serving statements that are uncontested in the benefit of the opposing party and impose a judgment on that absent client. I disagree with you strongly. And your circuit has already ruled on this issue. There is ruling on this issue that conflict of interest such as this requires bringing forth the client into the presence of the court. And furthermore, you're still stating all these statements that come from attorneys. The set of attorneys over here, the defendant's attorney self-serving for himself. Are you going to decide cases based on statements of attorneys alone when you've said that statements of attorneys are not evidence? And I mean the whole court has said that. Yeah. You can't. You can't do that. That's the thrust of our argument. Now, we have other arguments, but keep this in mind. All these defaults that you're saying, oh, the case couldn't go forward, it couldn't do this, it couldn't do that. Ms. Ortega was represented during all that time. And all of a sudden, it comes up at the pretrial when the attorney did not file his papers timely. That's what they said. Now, the attorney needs somebody to blame, or else he's got a $4 million malpractice suit on him. No, you don't really want to go that way with this court. I suggest to you that you should reconsider what you're stating and your take on this. No, the district judge's power is not that broad. And no, they have to have evidence to rely on. And if they don't have to have evidence to rely on, we're going to all be in trouble. And if all we take is statements from people that appear before us in a professional capacity that are self-serving, we're going to be in trouble. And this court has ruled also that you cannot just accept as a district judge the party's findings of fact and conclusions of law and put your rubber stamp on them because it'd be too much work. You've got to go grunge it out like appellate attorneys do here with references to the record to support what you're concluding. Please don't sweep this horrible ethical violations under the rug. This case should be reversed if for no other reason it's for Ms. Ortega and the ethical violations. As far as Mr. Accord, who's pro se, he should have the deference of a pro se person. He should at least get a warning that your mother's got this expensive attorney, but you can't adopt the pleadings.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Excuse me?
Thank you. Your red light was on.
I'm sorry.
You've got some time for rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
Mrs. Freeman?
Good morning. My name is Mark Freeman. I represent Young Again Products. I'm here with Thomas Freeman. I think that this case, we're revisiting issues that, at least in part, decided by this court, Mutual Federal, Mobile Oil, the Saudi case, the Rab case. But this case is different. This case doesn't just involve 13 months of subterfuge or game playing or commendable restraint by the judge during a discovery process. This case involves a issuance and the entry of a permanent injunction by the district court, and then a year...
Which was agreed to by the party.
Yeah, it was agreed to. But in the record, there was originally a hearing...
I'm not talking about originally. Originally, a lot of things happened.
I understand.
Then people agreed, and that's what the judge did, right?
That is correct. It was an agreed-to judgment on the just prior to the argument. Basically, it was a concession.
It's an agreement. I don't know who conceded to who. That's not before us. What we have is an agreement. Okay, go for it.
Certainly, that there was an agreement. But in appellant's papers, they suggest that there was a fee-sharing of some sort as far as the sanction was concerned, as far as our first motion to enforce the permanent injunction. The first motion to enforce the permanent injunction resulted in $1,800 of attorney's fees and costs that were Young Again products. The order itself talks about the fact that Young Again products was to be paid by cashier's check from the appellants $1,800. Those weren't shared fees on both sides.
Did the court ever give either of the appellants a warning that the default judgment was going to be entered if they didn't comply with the district court's order?
I think the district court did.
Can you tell me where that is in the JA, please?
Yeah, I think that the district court on November 17th, 2008, and to be fair, he didn't say, I will default you.
So there wasn't a warning.
Well,
it
may be a matter of semantics as far as what a warning is.
But default judgment, you look like you've been a lawyer a little while, is a pretty serious remedy, and it has meaning all of its own. I'm unhappy with you. My patience is running thin. I think you're playing fast and loose. None of those things tell a litigant, I am going to issue a default judgment unless you comply with these orders. And what I'm asking you is if there's something in this record that says that.
I think it's clear that it's in the record that at the
okay, November... Okay, tell me the reference, please.
We don't have the actual...
But
I can tell you, I don't have the actual site of the record, but I can tell you that on November 17th, 2008, and certainly the record is 9 volumes, but on November 17th, 2008, Judge Titus actually said, at the end of the summary judgment hearing, please read the rules, our rules,
right,
pretrial, as to what is required on pretrial. I take them very seriously. I don't want any playing around. This is a significant endeavor. To me, to me, that certainly is a warning, because
He doesn't know the thing. But it's there. I remember that.
Yeah. And that, to me, what is a warning? What is the expectation of a litigant? What is the expectation of counsel or anyone else when a federal judge or any other judge says, you better read the rules. I take them very seriously. I don't want any game playing.
Your position, I think, is in response to Judge Motz's question, which I also had. There is no explicit warning. There is no specific statement by the court that default is imminent. What you would say, I gather, is that without using those precise words, the district court made it as clear as it possibly could that its frustration was reaching a point at which default could be expected, that a reasonable participant would have taken his statements to convey the fact that default was imminent. Is that a fair characterization?
I think it is, but it goes even further because the court specifically directed the parties to the rule, and the rule specifically says that the parties can be defaulted if they don't follow the procedures.
But the rules also have other sanctions that can be granted or not. And that's where I think your rub is. Because if I tell you, I want you to read the rules and to know the rules, and you better come back here and follow the rules, and the rules have 14 sanctions, the 14th one, which is you have default judgment, and the first one is you have to pay court costs of $100. How is that warning that you're going to have the default judgment imposed on you?
Well, I think in the context of pretrial, and the decisions, I was unable to find the issue relating to warning in anything but discovery cases in the research that we did. We are now at a pretrial. And the pretrial order, which I look at differently, because we all know that once we get
Have you ever been granted a default judgment in another case disjunction?
I'm sorry.
Have you ever been granted a default judgment in another case disjunction?
I haven't had the circumstance. I haven't had the circumstance.
I haven't either. Longer than you have.
But I have had the circumstance where someone does not preserve an issue in a pretrial. For example, John Accord. Didn't preserve any issues.
You're entirely right. That person might be required to go to trial if he failed to preserve the issue of pretrial, but that is a different sanction.
But if you don't file a pretrial at all, you have no evidence, you have no witnesses, you have no documents, you have nothing. Essentially, what is what's an alternative sanction that might be available in that circumstance?
Available, you could still cross-examine, you the defendant, could cross-examine the plaintiff's witnesses. That would not be something that would be foreclosed from. You would be foreclosed from relying on anything that should have been in your pretrial order but was not. But let's leave the gentleman behind for a moment and go to his mother. Well, I understand who counsel did, in fact, make contributions to the pretrial order. Isn't that right?
Well, actually, interestingly, it was 1 hour before the filing of the pretrial order. I think it was a Monday. Something was faxed over to our office, which was then included.
You ever had anybody file their submissions for the pretrial order late before?
Actually,
never.
Every
case I've ever had in Montgomery County, people filed late.
The rules, I would say.
I'm not asking you what the rules are. I'm asking you what the practice is.
Yeah, I would presume you are correct. People do file things late. No one filed a motion to extend the time. And essentially what was filed and what Judge Titus said was, look, what I have before me is essentially worthless. And if you actually look at the pretrial, it was essentially worthless because all of the exhibits, including the liability expert reports, including the damages reports of Young Again Products, were incorporated in what was insufficiently sent to my office an hour late.
They well may not be able to prevail.
But
I don't understand why that gets you right to a default judgment. Because they've done a bad job at the pretrial order.
Well, the point is, at the pretrial conference, there are certain, I guess what are we going to do is to say, is to have the Fourth Circuit say you don't need to follow the rules.
No.
You don't need to comply with Rule 106, which is the local rule. You don't need to reply.
How long did the pretrial process last in this case?
Judge Titus set the case in for pretrial. 3 months went by before the actual pretrial hearing. It was 3 months in which neither John Accord nor Marcella Ortega
filed your submission.
Actually, the way that it works under the local rule, I had to submit my submission to the other side, which I did timely. Then the other
which was when? It wasn't at 3 months out.
No, that's
it
when
was like a week out.
Well, actually, I think it was 30 days out because it's, and I could be wrong. It might be 2 weeks out.
Right.
Our office specifically wrote two different letters to John Ortega and Marcella Ortega saying, please comply with the judge's orders. Please participate in this process.
As I read this record, and I've looked at a lot of these records, but the defalcations here almost seem to me to be unprecedented in severity. The courts in Texas and Utah had the very same difficulties here, and there are even admissions that the judicial process is being abused, and there's an email in which a court says he's filing numerous motions to quash discovery respect on Mason, other actions that will hopefully deplete his war chest. But the trial court just couldn't get anything done. I mean, there wasn't anything that was going forward. There was a consent injunction, true, but the consent injunction was supposed to be in a situation where the Young America, Young Again Nutrition, was going to notify its distributors that they should stop infringing. And instead of the distributors being notified to that effect, an inflammatory notice was sent out which almost encouraged them to continue the infringement. And so other consent injunctions had to be issued, and they too were violated. But in addition, all the things that we rely upon to make the judicial process go smoothly and to enable other litigants to be able to draw upon judicial resources without one set of litigants consuming the court's time completely. And I think the difficulty here is the pattern and the court's patience. The court didn't just fly off the handle here. There's specific examples of not only, of failures to comply with discovery, failures to show up for scheduling conferences, refusals to pay sanctions. It almost reached the point of a kind of an open defiance of the court's orders.
And I think
that's what we're dealing with.
And I think that that's exactly what Judge Titus said. He said, when I have litigants come in here and thumb their nose at my admonitions, and when I tell you to read these rules based on the entire history of the case, I can reach no other conclusion that you are not prepared and have no interest any further in defending this case.
Could I ask a specific question about this notice? Whether or not the defendant was on notice that default was likely to be forthcoming. It seems to me that there are a couple of facts that I read as working in your favor. The district court did not impose default sua sponte. It was responding to two motions that you filed. And the district court granted the motion for sanctions before the imposition of default judgment and also included the trial schedule within the same order. Am I recalling that correctly? So sort of combining the scheduling order with the order imposing sanctions for, among other violations, causing unnecessary delay would certainly suggest that failure to follow the pre-trial schedule could result in additional sanctions.
Well, I don't think that, and I think that that's what this court and all and the Supreme Court of the United States make clear, that the ultimate sanction of default must be available to the district court in appropriate cases, not merely to penalize those whose conduct may be deemed to warrant such a sanction, but to deter those who might be tempted that such conduct in the absence of such a deterrent.
But I think what the question is getting at is, wasn't a graduated process followed here? The district court just did not jump to the most draconian remedy.
I think that's right. In the first motion for enforcement,
it was a graduated thing.
There is no doubt that that is true. There was an imposition of sanctions on 4/16/2004 relating to the violation of the consent injunction, no doubt. And it was a consent injunction. But the point is, you still have to follow it because they're continuing to trade on our trademarks. There was Judge Titus specifically.
I think you sort of missed the question here. I think Judge Duncan has sort of put forth for you your best argument with respect to the default judgment for Mr. McCord.
Yes.
And maybe it's enough. There's no explicit warning. Maybe there are all of this other conduct. Maybe it's enough. Maybe you can address the entry of the default judgment against his mother, because we don't have sanctions issued against her. We don't have any of this kind of warning against her.
Well, actually, we do.
We do.
Okay. We do.
Where is that?
At JA Volume 1, page 416,
yes.
There is an imposition of plaintiff's costs and attorney's fees associated with the violation of the permanent injunction. And that was an agreed-to permanent injunction, but they paid our attorney's fees and basically...
And how long was that before?
I'm sorry?
When did that take place?
That was on all the way back to April 16th of 2004.
So what, $1,000 in attorney's fees?
Well, it was
2004 put her on notice that it was going to be a default judgment?
No, it was 1,800. I think the question was whether or not there had been prior acts of violations or notices by the court.
Well, perhaps I'm misreading the record. I thought her situation was different. I thought there were more warnings, sanctions, et cetera, imposed upon the son and the mother. And is it your representation as an officer of the court that that's incorrect?
Oh, no, as far as the default is, I thought that the question, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I thought that the question was, over a pattern and practice over years that Judge Wilkinson was talking about, there had been certainly admonishments by the court.
In the amount of warning one could get from earlier sanctions or harsh language, because my children used to say, don't speak to me harshly, Mama.
That
the mother received rather than the son.
I think that the warning, Your Honor, was what Judge Titus had said at the end of the summary judgment, which I've just gone through, as far as Mrs. Ortega is concerned.
That's the only warning.
Well, and I think that you also have
to... You know, this really isn't... I mean, the answer is yes or no. Was there a difference between the amount of warning, either in sanctions or in language from the district judge given to the mother, as opposed to the son?
From the district court judge, no. It was the same one.
It was the same. He gave exactly the same. He imposed exactly the same amount of sanctions on both. He said exactly the same thing to both.
Well, I mean, he said both. I'm sorry if I'm misunderstanding your question. He certainly was in court. I think Ms. Ortega was there. Certainly her lawyer was there when he made the statements. I can say that as far as...
I understand your representation.
Mr. Lobsher himself...
It's a good question, and your view is that of course, the court was proceeding pro se, and
voluntarily
proceeding with counsel, but your view is that when you look at these, there was no differentiation, and that's your representation.
No differentiation as to...
As
anything.
What have we been talking about?
No differentiation as to the warning. The judge gave
as to displeasure with the
when the court was expressing its displeasure with the litigants.
Yes.
All right. When the court was expressing its displeasure with the litigants, the various expressions of displeasure and concern and warning did not separate them out. It was a displeasure with respect to both of them.
That's correct. And certainly his comments, when he defaulted them, indicated Mr. Accord, he finds his excuses entirely and woefully inadequate, and one wishes to participate at trial before this court. We have a participatory process, and when one thumbs his nose at the process, the only conclusion I can reach is that you simply don't wish to defend the case. As it relates to Ms. Ortega, that was essentially the same thing. This case has been here way too long.
Okay, I just want to be sure that we're not ships passing in the night. I'm not asking you, and Judge Wilkinson isn't asking you, whether the district court treated the two of them differently. What I'm, as far as giving the ultimate sanction of a default judgment, what I'm asking you, what I think Judge Wilkinson was asking you, is whether they were treated differently up until that point. I want you to think carefully about your answer to that. Because your whole point in response to the question from my colleague was, well, the gentleman was put on notice because he was along the way sanctioned, this way, sanctioned that way, refused to pay sanctions. I don't remember, for example, her refusal to pay sanctions. Now, I will be back looking at the record. No, we can all look at the record, but if you tell me they're treated exactly the same.
No, she did not refuse to pay sanctions. The sanctions that were issued were paid. I'm sorry. My time is.
I was also interested in the.
But in every other respect, they were treated the same, according to you.
No, but certainly, I do apologize. I'm not quite sure I'm getting what you're asking.
Let me just say something to you, yeah, sir.
Yes.
And take this to heart.
Yes.
The court's questions are not meant to be hostile. They are an attempt on the part of the court to gain information.
Yes.
That's all we're doing.
I understand.
Now, we're trying to get, it's a very serious case, we're trying to get information.
Yes.
And you don't seem to be picking up on any of the questions here. Now, you know, the questions actually, some of them go to the strengths of your case.
Yes, you're right.
You understand that?
I do.
But you don't seem to be picking up. It seems to me that you could be giving a good bit more straightforward answers and assisting the court with its attempts to get information. Instead, you're hemming and you're hawing and you're pushing back and you don't seem in particular command of your material. And it just, I don't understand it because the court's questions aren't meant to be antagonistic. We're just trying to get information. And some of them actually underscore the frustration and difficulty that the district court was experiencing with these litigants and with this case.
I think I've let you down. I apologize.
And I apologize.
Questions have not been clear.
I certainly apologize.
But maybe try to answer that last question about the parity between the two defendants. You stand by your question that they were treated the same? You stand by your answer?
By the district court?
Not with the final sanction. I know that. I can read that in the record. But prior to that.
There was a distinction between John Accord and Marcella Ortega as it related to what they were doing in the process. But they were certainly treated the same as it relates, as we set out in our brief. And I apologize. I'm not trying to be combative at all. I just don't want to misrepresent anything in the record. So I was trying to be clear. Certainly, there was a pattern in practice and a difficulty involving both of these defendants over the course of 5 years. Mr. Accord didn't pay a sanction fine. Ms. Ortega didn't have a sanction fine. She was not proceeding pro se. So in that respect, they're different.
But in with respect to the district court's expressions of frustration with respect to what might be characterized as dilatory tactics, the district court, as you recall the record, did not make a distinction between the two? As you recall the record?
I don't think so.
Thank you.
Well, you have some rebuttal time.
You can't rely on statements of attorneys to describe the record. Like us that go down and grunge it out in the field, you got to take the record and go through it and read it and provide the courts with the citations. If you do, you'll find agreements where they paid somebody's attorney's fees. They paid the other side too, I believe. I believe that's in the record. And I believe that these agreements cannot be a course of obstreperous conduct. A court's denial of sanctions with a very specific warning might be, but there's no specific warnings in this particular case about any default.
Maybe you can address the question if there was a difference in the court's reaction prior to the grant of default between Ms. Ortega and Mr. Court.
I have a different view on it, but it's similar to what I infer is being expressed. I don't think there's any different treatment of Ms. Ortega until she gets to the default section where the attorney is allowed to bail out when her own son got rid of his attorney a year and a half ago. We don't cut and run in the trial practice on 90-year-old women. And we don't blame 90-year-old women for our ethical duty to go at a pretrial 3 months later. If he's not cooperating 3 months before the pretrial, if he's not getting any cooperation, does he get to wait until the pretrial? Is that Fourth Circuit practice? He gets to go in there, and at the ultimate moment when he's arguing an important default resulting in a $4 million judgment, he gets to run up the flag of surrender and say, gee, this is all my 90-year-old client's fault. I want to depart from this case. And the judge says, you're a fine attorney, Mr. Lobsher. Certainly depart from the case and turn around and slam a 90-year-old lady with default. I have not been treated so kindly in my past. When an attorney practices 30 years, he runs counter with the court sometimes when we make arguments like this. And I can tell you that's not good practice and that's not ethical practice in any circuit. So no, she was just lumped in there with her son. And you reach outside the record to other proceedings when the record in this case is not good enough to sustain the judgment. That's what I just heard this panel doing. And that should not be permissible. This case should be judged on its own merits, especially when Ms. Ortega's got an attorney, because he stands between the court and the client, and he's supposed to make sure ethical practice goes on, and he's supposed to keep his client in line. And if there was a bunch of trouble with Ms. Ortega, there should have been motions filed long before that pretrial hearing. We all know that. And can you enforce against Mr. Accord 97 days in jail where he rotted for a Rule 11 sanction? There has nobody been seems concerned about that. He sits in jail there, and all he did was file a motion for contempt because they sent a disparaging letter. And guess what? If you look at their briefs, I think you're going to find, check me out, that they said that that injunction that they violated was illegal because it violated the First Amendment, so they ought to be able to disparage, and the other party shouldn't. What these attorneys have done is carefully done, gone through their own statements that were made along the line in the record and tried to juxtapose them into the facts when this judge simply says, for the reasons expressed by these attorneys in their unsworn statements, I'm going to find that all these parties deserve this $4 million sanction and judgment. That's the case that you have if you stick to the record here. This case is governed, and this will be my final comment, by Hillig versus Commissioner, the Fourth Circuit, 1990. Long ago, a dismissal sanction is usually inappropriate when it unjustly penalizes a blameless client for the attorney's behavior. There is no evidence in this record that the taxpayers were responsible for their attorney's noncompliance. There is no evidence on Ms. Ortega. You got comments of counsel. If you were sitting there as a district judge, you'd say, you know, these comments are interesting, but I remember these courts of appeal cases, and we have to go by them, and they say that attorney's comments are not evidence. So let's go. Get up on the stand. Prove it out, like they used to tell me in Texas. Get up there on the stand. Prove up your case so somebody can be penalized under oath if it's not the truth. Right. And thank you, sir.
Appreciate it. Will I come down?